Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
So, Bob, do you golf?
I used to golf a lot. I almost got my first divorce over golf, and my second and my third.
Yeah.
But it was the 19th hole that got me more into trouble than the first 18. I used to love the golf. I was pretty good. I was shooting the low 80s.
Yeah.
If it got any colder, I wouldn't
know. I don't really know what any that means.
But... that was a joke.
Okay.
If it got any colder, I wouldn't go out. You know, give me a chance to finish,
right? Oh, I see.
Yeah. No, I golfed. I enjoyed it a lot, but with Hidden Hill, is just no time, and I don't miss it.
And it does take quite a bit of time, doesn't
and
it?
And money. Expensive
time,
these
money,
days.
And like... keeping what we're going to find out is the amount of time it takes to keep everything looking beautiful.
Enormous.
We're going to head out to Valhalla today and talk to Mark Wilson. Mark's the superintendent of Valhalla Golf Course. And great guy. And, you know, he was there when the PGA Tour came several years back. I mean, he's been there for a long time. So, you know, Mark's well entrenched in the pressures of making sure the golf course looks extra fabulous, because basically it looks really good all the time.
It has to.
But extra fabulous for all these special events that come to town. So we're going to find out what they do.
And this is the World Series of Golf. Mm-hmm. Alas, no Tiger this year. But
Might keep the traffic down a little bit.
That's not the point, young lady.
I know, but it's out in my neck of the woods.
Oh,
so, yeah.
You don't golf, apparently.
Andy does, and he's very good, in fact. He doesn't get to do it very often.
Yeah.
But no, I don't follow sports so much.
I don't think traffic, low traffic is one of the goals here.
I know, you're right.
The whole town's been dressing up for this for months.
Somebody was telling me that they heard like one of the late night talk show hosts joke about how scientists have finally figured out the lowest possible number or something like that.
Yeah.
It'll be how many people are watching the Ryder Cup since Tiger's not going to show up.
Oh, it's still a big deal.
I think so, too.
And kind of the, not the antichrist of golf, but this is kind of funny. We're going from golf to goats.
Really, if a goat got loose on the golf course, there might be some nervous people.
There'd be some food in the cafeteria. Yeah.
But they're using goats out in California. And right now, because of the wildfire season that they've had this year, too, it makes even more sense, really, in terms of how they need to manage it. But they're using goats to clear the underbrush, which then creates somewhat of a natural fire barrier, right?
Well, they eat about everything. Uh-huh. My wife, Janet, has some funny stories about, she grew up on a farm, and there was a goat that literally when her mother would bend over to hang the clothes or something, here comes Billy.
Yeah.
And butt my mother-in-law. We still talk about that fondly.
Yeah.
So goats,
they
goats
butt
are,
and eat.
But they're coachable, apparently.
It's a great idea. And like with gas prices, who needs to use a gas-powered mower or equipment to clear some of this stuff? Why not send a goat out?
And keep them out there.
Keep them out
Where they
belong. So we'll be talking with folks out at the Sacramento Wildlife Refuge where they're using goats to reduce the understory. That's coming up today on Homegrown. Hey, what's going on in your garden?
Two of the more unpronounceable plants in the horticulture business, but I've always had, is it poinsettia? How do you pronounce it?
Potentilla.
Potentilla, angst. I couldn't get it to grow. Uh-huh. Potentilla, you know. This year, hallelujah, bright yellow flowers everywhere.
It just took a while to get established.
I didn't wait long enough, I think.
Okay.
I think maybe, because I thought it bloomed in the spring and I'd be cutting it back and, you know, I'm an expert here. I'm cutting off my flowers. But they're gorgeous this year.
Yeah.
So I'm now a Potentilla fan. I wasn't before. And they come, it's more of an exotic plant than I realize. There's a lot going on.
It's kind of reminiscent, I think, of St. John's wort, don't you think?
Yep. Exactly. Which is my other plant, the Hypericum. Oh. I got a new one called Albury Purple. It's just phenomenal.
Purple?
It's got purple
is the foliage
leaves.
Purple?
Well, yeah, the foliage is purple. You know, the berries turn from like pink to blue, the transition colors. The foliage is purple and blue, and it's got these bright yellow flowers.
Mm-hmm. It's a
and
nice
it can't
plant.
Make up its mind what it wants to be. Mm-hmm. But this is the best cultivar I've ever seen. It's called Albury Purple. I recommend it to
folks. We've got a couple of nice ones, too, that are newer cultivars that perform very well as garden plants.
So my Hypericum and my Potentilla.
And it's a tough plant, too.
Yes.
Both of them are tough plants once they get established.
How about the Wishy State? What's up?
I got bad news.
Oh, no. Chicken related?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I don't have a full dozen of hens anymore.
Uh-oh.
I lost one. And...
You left home or...
No.
Worse than that.
Worse than that.
Uh-oh.
And it had to... It was my sister's dog.
Oh.
My own family.
You can't sue anybody that
can Billy. You? And it was one of those like... What are those Lemony Snicket books? A series of unfortunate events.
Yeah, right.
Sort of unfolded.
Yeah.
The kids were, I mean, and that's the thing. They were under supervision. Billy had been clearly fine with the chickens. But apparently there's a catchword that Billy responds
to. This is the dog, Billy.
This is the dog. And Georgie, my niece, was in the coop hanging out with the chickens.
Sure.
And she said, shoo, to one of the chickens to kind of get him out of the coop.
Yeah.
And apparently, because after my sister talked to the kids a bit to, you know, try to break down what really happened, Billy responds to shoo, like, go after this and get the stray dog in the yard away or chase this thing away.
Dog talk, yeah.
So when Georgie said shoo, Billy chased chickens and he one of them got a bunch of feathers pulled out basically, but she's okay. But then the other one was missing. The kids saw it. Billy ran off with that one and we found it later in the field, like up to the front of the house, which is good because at least it was away from the coop. And I think maybe a fox or something else came and ate the rest of it. But
it's the jungle out there,
kid. Yeah, and you know, I had this really strong attitude about, you know, we live in the country and it's a farm and, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But it still was really depressing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just glad it wasn't Box Girl because she's the only one that I can recognize. And she's kind of scrawny and small. And she's the one that sleeps in the box on the ground instead of on the roost at night. So that's why she has a name. But, you know, I can't tell them apart, so I don't really know who it was. But, yes.
Had you planned eating these chickens yourself at some point?
No.
Okay.
They're laying hens.
You're going to put them out in old folks' farm?
Right.
Old chickens' farm?
Because they're not, you know, you raise other kinds of chickens for eating.
I know.
And you're supposed to kill them, you know, when they're younger and stuff. And I don't know if I can do that, actually, after having them. I'm not as tough as I want to think I am, Bob.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's the sad news. But, you know, it's bound to happen. So, you know.
It is.
It is bound to
happen. It's life on the farm.
That's right. So, calendar. There are events around town, and if you're looking for some homegrown chicken, not mine, but there's a new farm market in town, Bob, which is always such good news. I love seeing that there's just more farm markets. This one's hosted by the Suburban Christian Church Farmers Market. It's located at 7515 Westport Road in, like, the Graymore, Devondale, Linden area.
Okay.
And this market is open every Thursday evening from 4 to 8. And they're open through October. So that's a good place to stop, you know, on your way home from work sort of thing. And it's one of those different sorts of days, you know, as opposed to the weekend thing. So 4 to 8 on Thursdays, the Suburban Christian Church Farmers Market.
Fair enough. And then Udale continues to have a really busy summer. They're doing a lot of things out there. They're cranking up out there. They're having a woody plant identification workshop, which is kind of the next level in gardening. If you're a gardener, professional, or somebody who wants to learn more about plants, at some point you have to learn ID, nomenclature, and what it all means, and
it
cultivars
helps.
And so forth. Udale's going to have a class Thursday, July 10th from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., a six-hour course on plant identification and what to look for and how to identify and so forth. So contact Udale for more information.
There we go. And the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tours this coming weekend, July 12th and 13th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So you want to check that out, especially if you like those. If you have a smaller space, great ideas in Old Louisville because most of those yards are a little smaller and kind of shady. Not all of them by any means, but a nice garden tour.
And I was talking to one of the organizers recently, and he said it's even more compact this year than usual in terms of walking around.
Oh, okay, good.
If you have a small space, there's no better place to find out what to do with it than at Old Louisville.
Not at all. But these folks do not have a small space to manage, Bob.
No.
35,000 acres out at the Sacramento Wildlife Refuge. And joining us now is Dale Schippelhoot. He is Assistant Fire Management Officer in the North Central Valley Zone of the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge Complex, which consists of 5 National Wildlife Refuge areas and 3 National Wildlife Management areas. The complex is there essentially to support the migratory birds that use the Pacific Flyway. In fact, they estimate that half of all birds that use the flyway, Bob, stop over at the refuge for a bite to eat and a rest. So it's an important space. Currently, wildfires have plagued the area. One of the things that the Sacramento Refuge is doing to manage the land defensively in this case is employing goats. And Dale Schippelhoot is on the line. He has, in fact, just returned from a fire incident. Dale, thanks for taking the time to join us and welcome to Homegrown.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I know you guys are awfully busy out there, and we really do appreciate your time. The situation is extremely serious in terms of the wildfires. Where is the refuge in conjunction to all of the fires that continue to pop up?
Well, we're currently in the north part of the Sacramento Valley, just north of the town of outside edges of the valley are national forests that extend up into the mountains from there, and all forests, essentially in Northern California, mm-hmm. have fires now that were a result of a lightning storm that came through this area a week ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dale, what's burning? Is it old-growth forest, or is it brush, or is it houses, or a combination of all those things?
It's a combination. Because the thunderstorms were so widespread, there are some areas where it was just brush, and there's areas where it was heavy timber, and a lot of those forests really are overgrown forests that have a lot of vegetation growing up in the understory, and a lot of heavy fuel loading, and so those locations now are really some of the tougher fires to suppress. Access is a problem, the fuel loading is a problem, and just lack of resources with the number of fires.
Any way to compare these fires to previous years or over the decades?
Oh, yes, that comparison has been going on. We've been hearing a lot about it over the past weeks. And, you know, it used to be that they would look at about every 10 years we'd have a big fire event. And now, even now, you know, in the past couple of years, they're just big fire years just about every year now.
So what are the causes? What are the circumstances, you know, seasonal or, you know, something that might have happened last year and then something that happens this year that makes for more fuel and a higher fire season?
Well, essentially, it's just the time has caught up with us of not getting, of suppressing wildfires across mm-hmm. the country. And there's just a lot of land out there that has not had fire on it. And so the fuel loading there is just building up more and more. Mm-hmm. And then whether it be global warming or just a change in the atmosphere and the environment, we're just getting less moisture in places. We're having drought conditions in places. And the conditions that we have right now are much like what we would normally have in August. Here mm-hmm. in this area, we typically have our biggest fire seasons in August and September. Mm-hmm. And we're having those same conditions now in June.
So, Dale, what are the traditional techniques of fire management? Because, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is about, you know, something a little bit more unusual in terms of using goats to eliminate some of that fuel load in the understory. But what are the more traditional techniques of fire management?
Well, the construction of fuel breaks or area treatments just to reduce the fuel loading would be prescribed fire would be one. Under certain conditions, you could put fire back onto the land to reduce that fuel loading. Another would be mechanical, to go back in with some sort of a tractor, whether it be with excavators or a mastication equipment, which is equipment that essentially chews up or molds mm-hmm. The vegetation and the woody debris. And then just bulldozers could be utilized, or chippers, that sort of thing. In addition to that, we often would use hand crews to go back into an area that really needed some thinning and remove the surface fuels and the latter fuels being the lower limbs of trees mm-hmm. and some of the brush in the area. And that's pretty labor-intensive, pretty expensive.
Sure.
Yeah, Dale, I was out in Montana and Idaho last summer, and it was the same thing. What can be done to change this? Just have to burn all the woods off once and start over again fresh and with better management?
No, I think it's going to take a combination, and we're probably going to need to accept in some places is that there may just be larger fires, and prescribed fire in some places is going to be really the only tool, because if the area needs treated is large enough, you wouldn't be able to go in and use manual labor or mechanical. And so one of the challenges is that burning puts up smoke, and so if you have a heavily populated area, we really want to reduce the amount of smoke, and so it's more difficult to be able to prescribe burn on some of the areas that we need burning and keep the air quality at the level it needs to be at for the population in that area.
Is most of the land public land, or is a lot of that private also?
There's a lot of private inholdings in there, and actually some of the areas around us now that are burning are private and state lands. Mm-hmm. And I think all land ownerships right now are being impacted by these fires.
So you came up with an idea a couple of years back to address this understory brush using goats. And you guys have employed goats at the refuge. Tell us how all of that has worked out for you guys.
Well, actually, utilizing goats is not really new, and it wasn't mm-hmm. It wasn't my idea. It's just that I had worked with goats on a previous job that I had worked on uh-huh. with, and when I came here to the refuge, then I just brought some of that information with me.
Sure.
And so with that, I had worked with it was a real interesting project with a 35,000-acre piece of ground that was owned by, I want to say it was around 40 different property owners. And they had this area that was really prone to wildfires and was really grown over. And they collectively, they got together and said, well, we need to do something about the hazardous fuels reduction here. What's it going to be? And they sat in a room, brainstormed, and they wanted to try and get some federal funds up front and some other grants up front to purchase a goat herd. And they would go out and do some mechanical work first, and they wanted to purchase, I think it was around 1,000 goats. And then that this group would then collectively own this herd and then have the herd maintain their fuel break at some level that mm-hmm. was an acceptable level mm-hmm. throughout the year. And so they got some grants, they purchased the goats, and then they hired a sheep herder, a Peruvian sheep herder.
Oh, wow. Herder.
And
he
then
they had
an old-fashioned barn building day where all of that community got together, and they built a big 40 by 60 barn, and mm-hmm. they milled it all on site with a mill right there. And they did the mechanical treatments, and then they ran these goats around on the ridge tops from one location to the next, and they had planned out a circuit for them through the year. So mm-hmm. in one month they'd be at one location, and then they planned on being in the higher elevations at another time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had planned on then building this herd and have it to be a sustainable system to where they would build the herd enough then to produce offspring that they could sell in the market,
mm-hmm.
and then that revenue would come back into paying for the herder, paying for the veterinary bills,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing.
So how did you take that model and make it work for you guys at the Wildlife Refuge?
Well, so when I went to the refuge and I came out here and looked at some of the our areas on the Sacramento River National Wildlife Refuge, it's a really riparian habitat that has just the stuff that goats would love. And so I thought, well, there's some areas that we needed to do some hazardous fuels reduction along the adjacent boundaries of our property where they butt up against houses. And instead of doing burning there or mechanical fuel work, we thought we'd try putting the goats in there mm-hmm. on a pilot project basis. And so far, they've worked really well.
Yeah. So did you rent the goats, lease the goats, buy the goats?
It was through a contract.
Okay.
There are a number of contractors out there that do grazing.
Okay. It's a fabulous idea. Goats, not tractors, huh?
Yeah, Dale, I'm correct. Curious, what are the social instincts of goats? Will they go back to the barn every night, or they run off into town and become a problem, or what happens with them?
Well, they hire somebody to stay with the goats during that period of time that they're on the project.
Uh-huh.
So they have, essentially, they put about 500 to 600 goats into a fairly tight area, and they have electric fencing that they put around. It's electric netting.
And then it's supervised.
So we determine the boundaries, the parameters, and then they move them from one site to another.
How many acres per site, roughly?
Around 20-something acres, and then we kind of move them on. Essentially, because it's a fuel break, it's on the outside edge of our properties, and we're butts up against houses, we have, they're kind of long, narrow units that we would have there.
Okay.
And so they're able to put the netting around for a couple of acres at a time, put the goats in there, and as soon as they eat it down to the level that is acceptable both for us and also we want it to be successful for the owner of the goat herd and the animals,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have to get enough value of food out of that. So when it gets down to that time where we both say, yes, it's time to move them, then we move them on to the next little piece.
You put them in a truck and move them?
We try to work it out to where on one project, they're just starting at one end and moving
just
through to
keep
the next.
On moving.
And they put them on a truck, yes, and uh-huh. they'll move them to the next location.
Uh-huh. So cost-effectively, is you know, contracting folks out for 500-600 goats to do this a better deal than having to use power equipment and gasoline and, you know, contract services in that way?
I would say it's comparable to mm-hmm. power equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But with prescribed fire, it's more expensive than prescribed fire. But prescribed fire, because this is a riparian habitat, it's
uh-huh.
not the kind of trees that really do well with fire. So
okay.
The fire would kill the cambium layer of these trees for the most part. And so we have to be careful about where we use fire in there. Okay.
Yeah. Has the theory been tested yet? Have any of these fires been in those areas where the goats have eaten?
Well, we just started here this last year, and I would say no, not on ours. I believe on other properties, other agencies have had some that they were. Now, I know that where we put the goats this year on a grass site near the community of Elk Grove down in the Sacramento area, they ate those grasses down to what was a stubble height on that grass of about a foot and a half is now down to about an inch. Mm-hmm. And that would make a tremendous difference in the rate of spread of any wildfire in that area and the intensity coming off of it. And so it really buys time for any fires coming off of the interstate right there and moving towards the houses. It would either stop it completely or it would really slow it down to buy time for the fire apparatus to get into there and put it out.
I know goats can come with certain odors. Do some of the homeowners nearby complain of the 600 goats out there in the neighborhood?
No, they're actually, in comparison to other animals, they're not. There's not as much of an odor problem, especially in light of their one that they're in there on a dry site, so mm-hmm. the pieces dry up fairly quickly.
Right.
And the males tend to be the ones that are more
mm-hmm. stinky,
smelly than the females. So mm-hmm. They put in the right kinds of goats in there.
The females are less stinky, so they get to do all the work.
Yeah, and the younger ones they'll put in there.
Well, where does this go from here? Other states, other areas in California wanting goats to come in and try
to save them? Yes, there are other places that use them. And they've also found that there are places that they've used them that it just didn't work well.
Mm-hmm.
And one I know of that, in some places where they put them into an area where the brush is really an old-growth brush and it's big plants, what they'll do is they'll go along and eat the little stems off the end, the new growth.
Right.
And then they'll leave the rest of it.
Yeah.
So you really didn't buy a lot by putting them in there, and they probably didn't get a lot out of it themselves to put on weight.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really they need some nice new growth stuff, and they need some fairly lush vegetation, or you would have to augment them with some other feed.
So as you all sort of collect all this information for, people trying to use the goats to manage different sites, do you foresee them being a key part of fire management in the future where, in fact, they do work?
I would say yes, where they do work. And there's been some recent work done in the University of Idaho, and there was also a workshop done here, I think it was out of UC Davis, and each of them had contributed towards a guide for, I think it was set up not as much for agencies, but for private landowners, especially mm-hmm. larger private landowners, where they could learn about which animals would be best for a specific habitat.
Yeah.
And so do you put cows there or do you put goats? And if you're putting goats, do you put the pregnant females there or do you put the younger animals in there that are trying to put on weight?
Because
mm-hmm. they all need a little bit different nutrient level.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like some homeowner associations in certain fire-prone areas should collectively go in and get themselves a herd of goats and have them managed in these fire breaks around their homes.
Is anybody doing that? Option, certainly. Uh-huh. And the challenge is that there's a lot of challenges to it. And one is, where do you put them in the winter?
Mm-hmm.
Depends on where you live. And is that an area that can winter them? And can you feed them continuously through mm-hmm. the winter on that site? Or you have to augment them with winter feed.
Part of an insurance policy, perhaps.
yeah. So there is actually a lot to it once you get into
sure.
it. But learning from those who have already gone through the process would be a big part of it. But yes, it would be a good tool. And if you didn't want to own them, I think the contracting is a good way to go to get them in and out
mm-hmm.
and move on.
And managed well.
Yeah, speaking of that, Dale, is there any chance of 600 barbecued goats in a wildfire? That would be a little PR disaster.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, that would be, that's something that you just have to be careful with, just like any other livestock owner in that same area.
Yeah.
Right.
That would be a far side strip saying, eat faster, Billy, eat faster, wouldn't it?
The fire's coming.
No kidding.
Right.
Wow.
But the meat goat industry is one of the largest, fastest growing mm-hmm. agriculture industries in the United States.
Yeah.
So for these cooperators or these operators that are putting goat herds out there for contract, then have
them up.
Pretty good resource to be able to get the sales out of the young.
Yeah. Well, Dale, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. It sounds great that you guys are finding ways for this to work. We know that you guys are really busy. We appreciate your time.
All right. Appreciate you having me.
Dale Schippelhoot is Assistant Fire Management Officer in the North Central Valley Zone of the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge Complex, where they have employed a team of goats to help reduce the vegetative understory to maintain a natural fire break and thus reduce the risk of wildfires in the area. For more information on the refuge, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, one of America's 100 greatest golf courses is in the Louisville area, and the Ryder Cup is right around the corner. We'll see what's going on at Valhalla. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we are sitting on a veranda overlooking the 18th fairway and green at Valhalla Golf Course. And the word green and verdant come to mind here, and they're not going to go away for a long, long time.
I don't think so. We hope so. Keep our fingers crossed that we don't have a drought this summer, right? So the job for Mark Wilson and his folks isn't going to be harder than I think they've already been working. But we are here at Valhalla with Mark Wilson. He's the superintendent of the golf course. Of course, everybody knows they're hosting the 2008 Ryder Cup in September. Mark's been with Valhalla since 1988, 2 years after it opened, in fact. He has a degree in ornamental and turf grass management. From the beginning, I guess, Mark, you knew you wanted to work with golf courses.
Yes, I did, because felt like I wasn't a good enough golfer, but I loved being on a golf course, so that was the avenue I chose, and it's kind of a sport in itself, maintaining a golf course, so I've been blessed to be able to wake up every morning and coming in here to maintain a golf course. So.
Yeah. So, Mark, I know a lot of people actually go to school, specifically get degrees, hardcore degrees in turf management, other things, especially today. Since you were in school probably back in the 70s, it's probably been enhanced a little bit today. But talk a little bit about what kind of training people that you hire go through in order to properly care for a golf course.
Well, a lot of times, specifically or more in general, what you learn is the science of turf grass management is identifying turf grass, which grasses, turf grasses you have. The next one is identifying some of the problems that you'll have with turf, diseases, weeds, those kind of things. And plus soils is always part of it too. I mean, basically that's where you grow the turf, okay, in the soil. So you get some background in soils. And then other things you get background is because pretty much everybody that does turf also ends up, they're involved with irrigation, they're involved with drainage, they're involved with horticultural end of it, they're involved with, you know, later on you're involved with road building and mowing it and everything else. So there's a lot of aspects, but a lot of it is you get the science of it, but then there's on-the-job training, and that's what you learn, too, by just working on a course. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, this had to be special for you. You worked at Audubon for many years, and you came here, one of the top golf courses in the country from the get-go. What special problems did Valhalla offer to you when you first came here in terms of the terrain and taking care of it as compared to Audubon, maybe?
Well, pretty much, I'm originally from northeastern Ohio, so I don't know where this place has as much problems that any other golf course in Louisville has, but you know, typically in Louisville, Kentucky, one of the hardest things we deal with is our climate, okay? We have extreme winters, we have extreme summers, and I think that's what you got to get used to more than anything else in the world. You do get used to the heavy clay soils, but also I found out with the heavy clay soils, that's sometimes a benefit too, because it does hold a lot of moisture for your turf grass and everything else. I think you started out the show talking about weather in particular. You know, the worst scenario that we would want to have with weather is wet and hot, not necessarily dry and hot, because we have everything that you see is irrigated. If we're able to control the irrigation, we're better off than letting Mother Nature control it. So my worst scenario wouldn't be a drought. My worst scenario would be wet and hot, okay, because then you get disease problems and weed problems and everything else. So us having to be able to be in control is the important part of what we do.
So I can go out in my yard and I can like spot treat some weeds and like, you know, which I don't really care about, so I don't do. But you have so much space here that you need to monitor for those sorts of problems. So do you have crews that go out daily, like on inspection, to see if there's a pest problem starting to creep up and take hold?
Yes, we do. We first of all, we're in controlled situations here. I mean, when I say control, we 4 acres of greens, 5 acres of tees, 27 acres of fairways that we pretty much do a regular routine preventative spray and keep up along with controlled irrigation. But we also do what we do with zone management. I have an assistant for each nine. We have a person in charge every three holes. And so part of my thing is that they're part of it, my eyes and my ears, and they're keeping track of their own things. But a lot of it's instinct, too. You know, the fundamentals that we have on our golf course started last year, so a lot of that is the best control for all these things is just having a good turf stand.
And how much has the course been changed since the PGA? You've known for 3 or 4 years it was going to be here, the Ryder Cup, but has every hole been changed, lengthened, shortened, greens adapted, or what?
Well, every hole has had, we've changed the grass, for instance. The greens have all been changed. In 1986, when we opened, we had the elite bent grass at that time, Pencross. And what we did is we regrassed all the greens 2 years ago to the new A1, A4 bent grass, which is a finer bent grass, and it handles humidity and heat a lot better. But I'm just talking grass there, but we've improved all our grasses. We've also, we've tinkered with every hole, okay? A lot of it was getting better sunlight, getting better air movement by cutting down trees or raising trees and everything else. We added on to irrigation. We built 4 new greens, I think 8 new tees, 20 new bunkers. So we tinkered with a little bit of everything. And that's how we kind of addressed every situation. We went hole by hole and said, what can we do to make this a better golf course?
Does Jack Nicklaus do that, or do you guys do that?
Both. Jack Nicklaus was quite involved. He made 3 trips here and trying to get it right, and along with the tournament director, Kerry Haig of the PGA, and myself, my staff. And we got a lot of contractors, tree service people. It's been a good team effort, and so it's been fun.
So when we're thinking about getting ready for such a big event like the Ryder Cup, I know there's certain considerations, sort of a checklist, if you will, of things that you need to think about. Certainly the course needs to be in very good shape. I would imagine that the improvements partly would be to make it harder. Is that true? I mean, just for the players. But you're hosting such a big event, you've got to make it agreeable to the spectators as well. So what are the considerations for you all as you sort of re-sculpt Valhalla for this big event?
I think we just took every hole by hole, and like number one tee, for instance, which will at 7:30 Friday morning, September 20th, that will be the most highest energy place in the world in sports. And so we, you know, that's just one situation where we addressed it, that we could get as many people around number one tee as we could possibly do. And plus, there'll be 250 corporations here with hospitality and everything else. And
so how many people can you get around that area?
We could probably get about 6,000-7,000 people around our number one tee now from a viewing aspect. But I was showing you number 18, where we can put 25,000 people around. Number 17 green, we can put 7,000 people around. We got a lot of great viewing sites. Plus, we'll have about, I think we got about 12,000 bleacher seats that we'll have for the Ryder Cup. So, and we're going to have 7 to 8 jumbotrons out here, so golfers might be playing golf in a different part of the golf course, but you'll be able to watch them on a jumbo screen. So
how big a staff does it take for you to get all this done?
Well, our typical staff is about 25 during the peak of summer, but this year we're at 35, and along with help from contractors, like I said. And then for the tournament week, we'll have 120 on our ground staff.
And how many people do you expect in attendance here, total?
We're expecting 45,000 spectators a day. 250 corporations will be here entertaining guests. We're supposed to have maybe 600 million households watch this live on TV, which will be 27 hours in 177 different countries.
That's got to be exciting for you as well as a challenge.
It makes me smoke one extra cigar a day.
All right, I'm looking out here, and I see, and I'm not a golfer, so I confess my ignorance in terms of the nomenclature and such. But there's all these different kind of levels of green and textures of green, which are also very pretty. But I suspect those are the different grasses that you guys maintain. Some stuff is cut very short, some is long. I do know that, you know, one is the rough and one is the green. So how many different kinds of grasses are you guys maintaining out here? And then what are the mowing practices like? I would imagine you've got mowing equipment running all the time.
Right. Now, the general rule of thumb, the shorter you cut grass, the more often you have to cut grass. So greens, you know, pretty much get cut every day at 1/10 of an inch. And then we mow our tees and approaches at 1/4 of an inch. And we mow them 2 to 3 times a week. We mow fairways 2 to 3 times a week at 3/8 of an inch. Mm-hmm. And then we have what we call an intermediate cut that we mow at 1.5 inches, and we mow it twice a week. And then we go to a 3.5 inch cut rough, and then we go to what we call a native rough area, which I renamed it Kentucky Horse Pasture because, and I do that because typically our native areas we didn't mow at all until the winter time, and this year we mowed them down two times, and now I think we're done. We'll just keep the weeds out of them. Mm-hmm. But what we wanted to have it up to about 8 inch to 12 inch, but we wanted to be able to have spectators walk through them. And then the final of the things that we do is zoysia grass, which is a warm season grass, and that's what we put on our bunker slopes because think about how the heat of sand, it's a different climate with the heat of the sand coming off of, and all our bunkers are relatively deep and they drain well. Mm-hmm. So I found out zoysia grass, a warm season grass, works best on those bunker slopes because of the drought and heated conditions they're under. Bent grass is made to be cut short, even though I mentioned those types of cut, but I also consider bent grass could almost be considered a warm season grass. It seems like the hotter and the more humid it gets, the more prolific it gets too. Matter of fact, bent grass contamination and in some of our bluegrass areas is one of the major problems that we have. Being able to control that in the bluegrass areas, it's been very difficult. So
are many of these grasses especially formulated for use in, you know, heavy use sports facilities like golf courses?
Yeah, I mean, all our grasses, especially when we were in new construction, was specified for certain areas. We used a lot of hard fescues always in our shaded areas. Hard fescues, creeping reds, sheep fescues and things. We put them in the shaded areas and in some of long grass because even if you let them grow, they don't grow much more than 8 to 12 inches, which is kind of what we're looking for. So,
when you redo a green, do you have to shut that particular hole down for the members or do you just build a green next to the existing one?
Well, we put out temporary greens. We just went out in our fairways and mowed a temporary green down for them. But, yeah, we reseeded greens, and we started from scratch where we lifted the old sod through it. You know, we actually gave it away to our golf courses, and then we actually fumigated them, or by that, they gassed them in order to kill all the weed seed and contamination that might be in them, and then we planted the grass. And usually when you plant grass, we can grow in a green from 8 to 10 weeks.
And the question I have to ask, because we get this asked all the time, are moles allowed at Valhalla?
moles are never asked to be anywhere. They just happen to show up, okay? They're always in uninvited guests. But we have mole problems just as well. Matter of fact, I used to get $20 for every mole caught, but hell, it got expensive after a while. So we have our share of moles. So,
And what's your recommended treatment to get rid of moles?
Well, We believe in trapping, but there is some new state-of-the-art, some of these new worms, tapered, you know, that really have been effective. You know, Dan Potter, UK, I mean, he believes in them too. But we still like the old trapping method just as well, or just the old knife. You just sit there and be patient enough. And, I mean, moles eat all the time. That's when they're moving, and that's when they're eating, and they like to eat. So if you wait long enough, you can find them.
And you just get them with your pitchfork.
The example is, I never go exactly after the mole. just to help you there, I always make sure I get about a foot behind them, because never just try to catch the mold. Try to get the trench behind it and start digging it out until you can flip them out. If you miss them, they'll just, you lost them. So.
Speaking of pests, were you all hit with the cicada emergence this year?
Well, the cicadas around here. We hadn't seen.
Anything major.
No, we're just starting to see some of the damage maybe on some of the trees where they're maybe laying their eggs or something. Nothing too bad, but yeah.
Mark, what was your last day off?
Well, I actually took off Father's Day, but yeah. But sometimes, you know, we're like farmers, golf course superintendents a lot. Farmers where, you know, it's 7 days a week and it's whatever we got to do. And so there's been stretches where we'll go 5 months without a day off too. So that's all part of it. But the advantage is we get a job we love to go to every day and get to get up every morning and wanting to come to work. So
anything on the schedule beyond the Ryder Cup for majors for Valhalla?
Well, I'm sure if we're successful, I mean, I think we've made too much an investment here at Valhalla not to have future tournaments, but you know, me personally, I focus on one tournament at a time, so that will come. I'm not even looking at September 22nd, which is the day after the tournament yet, so we'll get to that when we get to there. So,
like after Christmas, huh?
So are you disappointed that Tiger's not going to make it this year? I'm hoping it'll cut down on some of the traffic in Middletown.
Well, I hadn't gave, you know, you're hearing it strictly from me now. I hadn't gave up on Tiger yet. We know he's not going to play, but I want to invite him to help us out on the grounds crew. I'm getting ready to email him or write him. I'm going to get his number and give him a call and see if he'll help us out with the grounds crew.
Maybe that'll help with a little rehab for the parts he needs fixed.
All right. You think about it, I'm not sure he'd say no.
He probably wouldn't.
Nobody's probably ever asked him.
Tiger Woods, mole chaser.
All right, Mark, it looks like you guys are in pretty good shape. Thanks so much for spending precious time with us. I know you're busy.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go play 18, man.
Mark Wilson is the superintendent of Valhalla Golf Course, where they are ready for the masses to descend for the Ryder Cup in September. For more information, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL from Valhalla Country Club. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
We have one question apiece.
We do have one question apiece.
That's equitable, fair.
It is.
And perfect.
Perfect.
I'll start first.
All right.
This man must be related to the Pilgrims. I love his name. His name is Justin Mullins.
That was a nice name.
There was a Pilgrim named Mullins.
And there was a Pilgrim named Justin, too, I think.
I think so, yeah. So he's clearly, of course, we all are, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's got a question about bell peppers, which wasn't a problem on Plymouth Rock.
Yeah.
He said, I grew many from seed this spring and transplanted the third week in May into the garden. Of the 12 plants, only six seem to be growing. The same goes for a few in containers. I've added fish emulsion and now placed some fresh green compost around the plants. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with them? I want a thriving pepper crop. Justin Mullins.
Justin, be patient. We have talked about this whole notion of setting plants out too early. And certain plants like it hot. We usually talk about tomatoes in that regard.
Yeah.
But peppers are the same way. Cucumbers, beans, they like it hot. And if you recall, we had a very cool start to the season, did we not?
A couple of hot weeks and then it leveled off again.
And it was also real rainy back then too, wasn't it?
Yes.
So basically your plants just got, what's the word, Bob? A bad start.
Yeah.
So they're going to be sluggish, and it'll take them a little while to catch up. They like it hot. It's been hot. They don't like it real wet either. Good drainage is preferable. All of that. So you should start to see some recovery now that the summer's looking a little bit more like summer.
And
is
once
what
they
I'm guessing.
Crank up, buddy.
Yeah.
You're going to have peppers.
But and next year, just Justin, remember, don't even if. Even if it seems right on the calendar, you know what I mean? Like by then we should be putting our peppers out. See what the temperatures are
and just keep them inside where it's warmer, you know, until it gets hot outside. It was a weird spring. It was such a super duper slow start to the whole summer vegetable garden.
Everything else was fabulous. So
Yes.
It's a balance.
Right. It is a balance. But they like the heat. So just, yeah, they're stunted is what I was looking for because of the cool season.
Gotcha.
All right, Bob, here's one for you. This one's from Judy Dixon. She has a question about her knockout roses.
Okay.
She wants to know why they look so horrible. They looked so pretty earlier in the season, and then once it got hot, she said they, you know, by late May or mid-June, they started to look terrible. So she's wondering if she should cut off the spent blossoms, if she needs to fertilize or anything like that to help them.
Contrary to popular opinion, knockout roses don't look great every day all the time. And yes, you have to cut off, you have to deadhead them.
Mm-hmm.
When the flowers are spent, you get in there and cut them back to the next nice
leaf
or branch down. Deadhead them on a continual basis, and they tend to go in flushes.
Right.
We had a fabulous early bloom, and then all mine were all green for a while. Now they're coming back, and that's the way it goes.
That is the way it goes.
I've seen people that...
They need a rest period.
Yeah. And I've seen people balance them off where one's blooming and one isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But they're never going to bloom all the time.
Continuously.
Nothing does.
And, you know, they tout them as plants that you don't have to do anything to. So I wouldn't worry about fertilizing it because they'll be just fine. And you don't have to deadhead them, but... And they will bloom again, right. But they look better, and they'll bloom better if you do, right,
yeah,
Bob?
Yeah, and it looks better. The plant looks better.
It looks way better.
Yeah.
Because I'm starting to get, mine did the same thing just like yours did, and I'm starting to get that nice new growth, and it's red and fleshy, and it's pretty, and you will have blooms there.
And come fall, you're going to be blown away.
Because they'll be
the
covered.
Flush is incredible.
It is
just
incredible. It is. So there you have it.
Yeah.
And if you have a question...
If you have a knockout question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week reminds me of a joke either by... Mark Twain or Winston Churchill, I'm not sure which. Either one is capable of it.
Either one is capable
of
it.
Yeah, it was about a woman of whom it was said she was very modest.
Uh-huh.
And the answer was, she has much to be modest about.
All right, so that gives it away. The Latin word of the week is modesta. Modestum.
Town in California, too, I think.
Modesto, isn't it?
Yeah,
I was thinking about
that.
In honor of Sacramento... There's a little bit of a connection there, right? But it's modesta, modestum, or modestus. And in fact, it does
mean modest.
Modest or small, typically, right? Erebus modesta.
The Rouge Canyon rock crest.
Which is a very small little rock crest.
I want to see Rouge Canyon, Red Canyon.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Probably nicely nestled between the rock canyon walls. Erigeron modestus.
The Plains Fleabane.
Plains Fleabane.
Oregano is another cool plant, and it's not used enough.
It's not.
I've come to like that plant.
I have, too. And it's mighty useful when you're looking for Latin words of the week examples. Because it seems like there's a ton of different Erigorans, don't you think?
All the time.
Yeah. And another one of our favorites, Penstemon Procerus variety Modestus.
The Pincushion Penstemon.
Pincushion Penstemon.
Another great plant, the Penstemon.
A nice little small pincushion-like bloom
for
this Penstemon.
It's modest.
Yes, modest. Circium Modestum.
The Lacy Thistle.
Lacy Thistle.
I like that thought.
Uh-huh. So the foliage is lacy on this thistle, but it's a modest one.
It'll stick you, though.
Vaccinium Modestum.
I get that for smallpox, I think.
Mm,
no,
yeah.
It's the small blueberry.
That was good. Small blueberry, yes, not smallpox.
I don't want a small blueberry, though.
No, I don't either, actually.
Big, bold blue.
Clarkia modesta.
The Waltham Creek Fairy Fan.
Waltham Creek Fairy Fan.
I'll be
so everything about these modest plants... Not everything, I should say. Something about these modest plants is going to be small.
And they might blush, too.
They might blush, too.
Yep.
But that's okay.
Yep.
All right. That ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you join us next week for yet another edition.
Homegrown is produced by the recklessly modest Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.